Chief Justice Averson will not be participating in this case. Well, the third case for the day, the title is too long to read. We all know what it involves. So I'll call on Mark Thompson.
Thank you, Justice. May it please the court. My name is Mark Thompson. I represent Reamer Kaplan Reed. With me today is Lester Pines, co-counsel for petitioners. He represents Enneman and Nadler. Richard Rice is also here today. He is also counsel for petitioners Harrison, Barrowitz, and Levine. For purposes of argument today, I will be taking 20 minutes. Mr. Pines then will take 5 minutes, and you will also have the 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Rice has opted or been generous enough to give Mr. Pines and I an opportunity to share our views of this case with you. It is fitting, I think, that we hear this case today, a few days after the Badgers have won their second Rose Bowl game. It's a little over five years ago. These cases arose as a result of our petitioners going to the Michigan-Wisconsin game at Camp Randall Stadium. They sat in the student sections and in sections N and O, and they had tickets and they were sitting very close to the bottom of the stands. What they weren't told and what they weren't warned about was that at the end of the game, that gates would be closed across the bottom of the exits, and it would preclude any of the students in those student sections from exiting out onto the walkway, either out into the field or up into the tunnel. They were essentially penned in and corralled in. It is the petitioner's position that the state or the university defendants' actions, penning them in and leaving them penned in, were ministerial duties and not discretionary. This court has the opportunity to look at all the circumstances, evaluate the law applied to these facts, and restore balance, judicial balance that this court articulated were to be done by the exceptions to the common law rule for public officer immunity. This court specifically stated that its responsibility was to determine and balance the interests of public officers in their right to perform their duties freely against those aggrieved or injured and their right to redress. The action was commenced and the university defendants filed a motion for summary judgment based on their affirmative defense that they had pled on public officer immunity. The trial court, the Honorable William Johnston, determined that a court's danger did not exist and that therefore the defendant, university defendant's conduct was discretionary, not ministerial, and granted it. On appeal, the Court of Appeals didn't get to that issue, nor could it. It simply said, we assume for purposes of deciding the case, but without making a determination, that a compelling and known danger existed, and that the university defendants had a ministerial duty to act. But then, and this is a key issue, relying on this court's recent decision in Kemp's, determined that because the university defendants had developed a plan for crowd control, that their conduct then somehow was discretionary again, and granted immunity. The Court of Appeals decision is inconsistent with this court's decision in court. It eviscerates Kemp's, or its interpretation of Kemp's, essentially wipes out the ministerial exception to discretionary immunity.
Can you explain, Dad, why you think that the position wipes out, you asserted that in your brief also, that it really does away with the exceptions to immunity?
This court has clearly articulated that with respect to state employees, immunity is the rule and liability is the exception. But the court said where there is an absolute imperative duty.
I'm sorry, my question wasn't clear enough. You said it eviscerates Kemp's. Tell me why it eviscerates Kemp's.
And I eviscerates courts.
Oh, I thought.
And I meant to say that the Court of Appeals interpretation or application of Kemp's eviscerates courts.
Okay.
And they misread Kemp's. And the essence of the argument is this. Petitioners produced facts that established that Chief Reisling, and in particular, was aware that of the pinning effect that occurred when they closed the gates at the end of the game, with a few minutes left in the fourth quarter. At the Northwestern game on October 9th, a few weeks before the Michigan game, this surge and crush almost occurred. She was aware of that. Prior to 1993, and consistent with the building code, administrative code, ropes were used, not metal gates, which allowed for unobstructed egress to the field. In 1993, when they installed the gates and utilized them in such a way that they closed them and locked them at the end of the game, they created a condition to this public building that trapped these individuals. They were aware of this trap. And as a result of being aware of this trap, as well as being aware of other problems associated with an overcrowded section, I also packed up, and in anticipation of the students taking the field, they developed a plan. Now, CORD stands for the proposition that once a plaintiff demonstrates or establishes a known and compelling danger, then the duty is ministerial. It becomes a jury question. They lose the grant of immunity. That's what CORD was about. The park's officer manager was aware of the cliff, didn't put up signs, didn't warn. And this court said, look, the buck stops here. It's a ministerial duty. You know the danger. The Court of Appeals implicitly agreed with our position in that regard, that we had established a known and compelling danger, but then incorrectly determined that because they developed a plan subsequent to, that then they had discretion within that plan, and they were somehow cloaked with immunity again. But CORD stands for the proposition, once you have a known and compelling danger, it's a jury question as to what you did was negligent or not.
So that means that each time there is a plan, whether it happens to be this situation or some public official, a warden, police officer, etc., carrying out his or her ministerial duty, once they engage in a plan, that plan then becomes subjected to a jury. Each plan would then be subjected to a jury question.
I think the
is that too broad, but I mean
that's, I think that's a little broad, but okay, in particular,
where there is a known danger, whatever.
That's correct. Yeah. The point of courts is that when the state actor knows of the danger, then there is no discretion not to act. They have to eliminate and address the danger.
Mr. Thompson, what do you see as the known and compelling danger here? That obviously, there was concern when you read the plan. There was concern about the crowd coming onto the field and then perhaps tearing down the goalposts. There certainly is not, at least in that plan, that crowd control plan, any reference to this penning effect. Is that what you see as the known and compelling danger, or do you see the crowd coming onto the field as the known and compelling danger?
I would probably say that both work. The issue was there is no question that we produced sufficient evidence to have a jury question demonstrating that, in particular, Chief Reisling knew that the penning effect was very, very dangerous. Now, we also argue independently that there were standard operating procedures that she was obligated to follow, as were others, that I would construe as separate ministerial duties that added and heightened that risk itself.
Now, is it your claim that she knew about this penning effect because of the Northwestern game?
Well, that is one example of it. There were the first game of the 1993 season was a preseason Packer game. The first time they were used, Permar, who had manned the gates pursuant to the university instructions, you got to also understand that during discovery, Permar was pointing the fingers at the university and the university was pointing the fingers at Permar. They were both disputing who had control over what. It was our position that the university had control, but that Permar also had the right not to lock the gates. And they settled a Perringer. There was evidence from the beginning of that season that there was this pinning effect. As the momentum developed, as the team was successful, the excitement was heightened and heightened and heightened. This pinning effect became more and more dangerous. At the Northwestern game, they almost had this serious, serious injuries. They didn't do anything about pinning people in. Instead, they adopt a plan. The plan, though, didn't address the danger. Courts talks about when there is the danger. It's ministerial. It's a jury question is whether they've resolved that danger. They didn't. Now, the fact that they develop a plan doesn't then somehow get them around court's mandate in the first instance, that once you recognize the danger, it's ministerial. It's a jury question. They can't then develop a plan and say, well, we recognize a general danger, but not address the compelling and known danger itself.
Mr. Thompson, there strikes me as conflicting dangers here. Dangers to people on the field related to the goalposts and to the team, to officials, members of the other team, potentially. And then in danger to people in the pen. You seem to be saying that once a danger is recognized to people who are penned up, that danger has to be addressed irrespective of the conflicting danger. Or once the danger is recognized, it becomes a jury question. But if can you have it both ways here?
I don't think it's a question of having it both ways. Prior to 1993 and subsequent to the Michigan game, they used ropes. They did not have a fixed barrier attached to the tunnel. They did not pen in students. The code required that students sitting in the stands could leave their seats. You're entitled at the end of the game to an open court. You're allowed to get out. Now, historically, they had balanced those interests by using ropes, because they tried to use ropes to hold people back, to allow the team off, the band off. But if there was too much of a crush, they would simply drop the ropes. And then officers would watch for individual troublemakers.
Were there injuries on the field at some time in the past that caused that fence to be created?
I'm unaware of any injuries that did that. The record doesn't indicate that. And the only
why did they build the fence?
Well, the university, one university defendant, Mr. Green, said they just decided to put it in. He didn't even read the code without any management. I can't get into his head why he did it. The point was, regardless, and I don't want to second guess his decision to put it in, the point was once they put it in, and they were aware that they were corralling students in, and they were at grave risk of imminent danger, and especially after the Northwestern game, they had to take action. They didn't have discretion not to act anymore. They had to let the students out. And it's a jury question. The jury should decide whether or not that their conduct was negligent or not.
Well, what I'm just asking, I guess this is my follow-up on my first question. Anytime they put a plan in effect, and there's a failure of that plan, in other words, someone gets hurt, whether they get hurt through a pinned in effect, or they get hurt falling off the railing, or someone throws a piece of the seat on their head, or whatever, where do you stop with this thought?
Courts provides the analytical framework to address it in the easiest fashion. It says where you have the known and compelling danger, then you have to address that danger. For example, in courts, could the park manager have put a warning in the newspaper and published it, had a plan, but not address the danger associated with the gorge? Or in Domino, could the dispatcher have not immediately made steps to remove the downed tree, but simply made a call in, developed a plan, a call in to eliminate?
Could I give you an example? In a football game, you know, there's an alcohol-free stadium, but you know, they put a body search in, you know, they're standing there, and someone brings, you know, they have this plan. Someone brings a bottle in and flings it and hurts somebody, and is the next jury question that they didn't do a sufficient search? I mean, they had a plan. That's to have people not going into the stadium. I think it's open and obvious and known that if people throw things at football games, and they might throw a bottle, and I'm sure, without saying, people probably have been hurt at football games or other sporting events by flying objects. I mean, wouldn't that be the next, you know, if we go along with the argument, which is very good, then isn't that an open and obvious danger that people throw things and they had a plan to keep bottles out, they didn't keep them out, someone got hurt?
The courts, again, provides guidance, because the courts talks about whether that known and compelling danger was of such force. Now in the general sense or the factual analysis or the fact pattern you put out for me to address, there wasn't a specific known high risk of flying glass other than a general, it's a known risk. But what if they would have had a section of students that every game was completely out of control and every game threw bottles? And then they had a plan that failed to address it. See, I think that's the distinction, and that's what courts talks about. And see, Kemp's talked about the teacher and the loose bolts and said this wasn't a known and compelling danger. And so within that context, we're going to let the teacher make decisions about what's going to happen. That's unlike courts, where courts said there is this known and compelling danger, it's ministerial, then it's a jury question. Because otherwise, the state employee, knowing of this danger, could have a plan, develop a plan, and never address the real danger, and simply be shielded with immunity. And it would defeat and eat up the court's exception.
Let me shift, if I may, the phrase of known and compelling danger to the phrase of a duty so absolute, certain, or imperative. That's language out of courts also. What duty here was so absolute, certain, or imperative?
The duty to not pen students in like cattle, knowing that they were going to be crushed. I think that is that risk. They knew that they had to resolve that fixed barrier that would not allow people out.
But Mr. Thompson, if I may follow through on Justice Brennan,
The language which he quotes also continues on, and it says, involving merely the performance of a specific task, when the law imposes, prescribes, and defines time, mode, and occasion. It seems to me the problem that I have with your case is that there were a lot of ways Chief Reisling could have responded to this. She chose one. There was not just one way for her to act. There was clearly discretion as to, any number of ways that she could have acted. Unlike in court, where clearly a sign had to be put up. But here, it seems to me like there was a great deal of discretion and nowhere nearly the kind of imperativeness and certainty that is involved in our prior cases in which we defined a ministerial act. A ministerial act, it seems to me anyway, from our past cases, involves no judgment, no discretion whatsoever.
If my time's up, if I can answer your question, I would like to address that question.
That was it, please.
Courts is directly on point there. There were many, many ways that the park manager could have resolved that issue. The point was, and of course, is where that danger is so known and compelling, then you have to do something and it becomes a jury question. It becomes a jury question to resolve that. Here, the danger was so compelling, you could not leave them penned up. Now, you're true, there are many ways that you can go about doing it. You could open it up. There are standard operating procedures to keep the aisles clear. So, you have different ways to keep the aisles clear, but it's like a stop sign. They could have done many things. And they have done them. And that gets to our safe place claim, subsequent remedial measures. The point is it hasn't happened again because they opened the gates. The Ohio State, they eliminated the penning effect and thereby eliminating that crushing mechanism. Thank you.
Attorney Potts?
To Mr. Potts.
Thank you. Justices, I have 5 minutes, and I want to try to focus this argument on the problem of the questions of discretionary immunity, ministerial, all these things. We start out from the basic proposition that immunity for state officials is presumed to start off with. The next step is there an exception to that immunity? In this case, we assert that there was a compelling and known danger. We think the facts were before the trial court and the Court of Appeals to show there was a compelling and known danger. Once we have established that there was a compelling and known danger, and in this case, the compelling and known danger was that there was an overcrowded, rowdy section of thousands and thousands of young people. And the university defendants knew that, and they knew that they had the penny effect. Additionally, because of what happened at the Packers game and what happened at the Northwestern game, once we've established the compelling and known danger, the question of whether there was discretion that was exercised after that isn't a question that should be asked. At that point, the issue of ministerial or discretionary is out of the case.
So then no matter what she does, she can be liable.
If she is negligent.
Well, sure, but if she had done what you wanted to do and somebody else got hurt, then they could say she was negligent. I mean, excuse the pun, but this sounds like classic Monday morning quarterbacking.
Well, let's look at it this way. If this was a private stadium, and the same thing happened at a private stadium, we wouldn't be here arguing about discretionary immunity. The only question would be at that point, with the owner of a private stadium, was that owner or the person in charge of that stadium negligent or not?
Right, but as you started off, Mr. Counsel, the general rule in this state is...
That's right. The general rule is immunity. But once compelling and known danger is shown, then immunity is gone.
But
And the question is negligence.
Mr. Pines, this case was decided on summary judgment.
Yes.
Do you think there's a genuine issue of material fact in regard to whether or not there was a knowing and compelling danger?
Yes.
I'm just thinking we've got a situation where the trial judge apparently said no knowing and compelling danger. The Court of Appeals said just the opposite. So you are taking the position that there is a genuine issue of material fact.
Yes, the matter should have been tried. That we think there was. The state takes the position that their affidavits established there was no known compelling danger. We say that there was, that the facts show that there was. But for purposes of this legal discussion here, I just want to focus the court on the fact that if there was, then we don't have to talk about ministerial or discretionary. We just talk about negligence.
Let's go back and look at the law with respect to discretionary acts. Okay. If an act is discretionary, the general rule is we provide immunity.
That's right.
Now, are you saying that she had no discretion as to how she implemented a safe policy?
I'm saying that the question does not and should not be asked at that point. I'm saying that when a public official is responding to a known and compelling danger, that is, that the nature of the danger is compelling and known to the officer and is of such force that the public officer has no discretion to act, they have to do something about it. That's what we say this case was. Then it's not a question of then when they act, did they exercise discretion properly or not? That's no longer in the case. The only question at that point is, did they act negligently or not? That doesn't open the floodgates to lawsuits. That just puts a state officer in the exact same position that the state officer would be if there was no immunity. And there's no immunity when there's a compelling and known danger. And that's where the Court of Appeals got confused, because they then came back after saying, we assume there was a known and compelling danger, and then they came back in and said, but the actions in response to it were discretionary.
Well, that doesn't work. On the floodgates argument, if there's an averment that there's a known and compelling danger, and then the judge, as in this case, says no. Now, it just seems to me that each time that would be what you would say, it's annoying and compelling, therefore we're entitled to a trial, it's a material fact. In other words, we get beyond the summary judgment and we get to the jury. And so when someone asks, well, where is the stopping point, that's what I'm asking, where is it?
Well, if we look at Kemp's, in Kemp's, the plaintiff said, well, this was a known and compelling danger, and the trial court on summary judgment said, this isn't a known and compelling danger.
Well, that's what he said here, too.
In Kemp's, they said that. What was Kemp's about? Kemp's was about a teacher using gymnastics equipment in a classroom. You know, here, we're talking about the management of thousands of people. And we think the facts in the record would support the conclusion that was a known and compelling danger, but in any case, there are certainly material facts in dispute on that issue.
On that issue being?
Whether it was a compelling and known danger. I mean, the Court of Appeals concluded, well, we're going to assume this. But this case wasn't decided at trial, it was decided on summary judgment. That's an issue.
Your argument, Mr. Pines, there's a single compelling and known danger. But couldn't it be argued that there was more than one compelling and known danger? I mean, the danger of things on the field.
It could be argued.
If they opened the gates, if they didn't have the fence, and there was an accident on the field, that's a compelling and known danger. Oh, now what do we do?
I want to clarify. We're talking about two different fences. Or just so everyone's clear on this, there's a fence that goes around the field.
Yeah.
Then the way that it was constructed, a portion of that fence opens up and closes the track around it.
Yeah.
So the penning effect came from the closing of the track. And as far as I'm aware, there's nothing in the record to indicate that there was any concern about injury on the other side of the fence that goes around the field. The only concern for people getting on the field was the safety of the goalposts. Thank you.
You will be doing the rebuttal also?
Yes.
May it please the court, my name is John Glinsky. I'm Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the respondents on this appeal. With respect to the known danger type of ministerial duty, I think it's not only important but crucial that this court determine the nature of the danger that we're dealing with in these cases. The plaintiff's position appears to be that the danger was that created when the gates were closed across the track by the home team tunnel to enable the players and the field personnel to exit the field at the end of the game. The Court of Appeals, however, stated that the danger was the, quote, possibility of a crowd surge onto the field, unquote. And I think that is an accurate assessment of the danger, because that was the overall danger, which included many other dangers, and in fact, caused the other dangers. Give you some example of the other dangers that existed. There was the danger of fans going out onto the field and being injured at the goalposts, where they had been injured in the past, that they could go on the field and injure bad members, game and field personnel, that fans could be injured in the track area, which they were in these cases, that they could be injured at the fence separating the track from the field, which they were, that they could be injured at the railing separating the track from the bleachers, which they were, that they could be injured in the bleachers, which they were, that they could be injured by the players attempting to exit the field if the fans were allowed to go in front of the tunnels, that they could be injured by the equipment being removed from the field, that the fans in fact could injure anyone attempting to come off the field, the danger that the police officers could be injured, the danger that the firmar employees, the ushers, could be injured.
Mr. Glinsky, are you conceding that there was a known and compelling danger here?
If that danger, Your Honor, is defined as the Court of Appeals did, yes. Because there certainly was an expectation on the part of the defendants that if it was a close game and Wisconsin won, in all likelihood, at least some students would attempt to come onto the field. What was not a known danger was the unprecedented nature of what occurred. In the past, hundreds at most had attempted to come on the field. In this particular instance, thousands attempted to come onto the field, something that has rarely happened in the United States, had never happened before at Camp Randall, and something we associate with soccer games in Europe and South America. So if that's the kind of the danger we're talking about, then it wasn't known.
It was not known.
Then it would not have been known. We are comfortable with the danger as defined by the Court of Appeals, and if that is the danger that this court determines existed, then we're willing to concede that there was knowledge of it.
Is there any known and compelling danger as to the penning effect?
There was knowledge that congestion would start to occur on the track between the railing and the fence, because that had occurred even before when ropes were used. After all, the purpose of the gates is really no different than the purpose of the ropes. Both are designed to contain the fans temporarily until both the visiting team and the home team exit the field, as well as the field personnel. So this is designed to be a temporary measure lasting no longer than a few minutes normally.
It seems to me that there's a certain artificiality here. You're saying the Court of Appeals said the possibility of the crowd surge onto the field, and that you are conceding that is a known and compelling danger. And what is bothersome to me is that this crowd is surging, and that's what you're conceding, that that's a known and compelling danger. I think the reality is there's a gate. So why are you not conceding, other than for legal reasons, but for factual reasons, why aren't you conceding that if there is a crowd surge, which is a known and compelling danger, when that crowd surge meets with the wall of a gate, that that's a known and compelling danger also? I mean, it seems to pretty easily follow.
You have to understand, Your Honor, though, that unlike cords and domino, for example, where you had clearly defined pre-existing dangers, here you had dangers without any parameters. It could not be known, first of all, whether the students really would rush the field, although it's likely they would.
You already conceded that was a known and compelling danger, so you're already there.
All right. There was no way to know when they would attempt to rush the field. Would it be at the end of the game or prior to the end of the game? How many would rush the field? How quickly they would rush the field? Or where they would come from? Would they come from one section or several sections or all five sections?
Well, it was known that they wouldn't have rushed the field if Wisconsin hadn't won. That was one of the elements that you had to win first.
True. In that sense, I mean, no one could know for certain whether there would be an attempt to take the field, but there was an expectation.
I hate to say that should be a known danger that Wisconsin's going to win,
but there was an expectation that the fans would. So the whole purpose of developing the plan was in anticipation of the students attempting to take the field. Had that not been anticipated, the plan would never have been developed.
Mr. Glinski, I'm confused by your concession, and I think it's important that we clear this up, at least in my mind. It sounds to me like you are conceding that there was a known and compelling danger in the sense of that something bad could happen. But you are not conceding that in a legal sense there was a known and compelling danger. Is that what you're saying? For purposes of a ministerial act? That's what I hear.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is it depends on the definition of the danger. That's why it's important that this court define the danger in this case.
We were to define known and compelling danger as being the situation that happened, then you would not concede that this was a known and compelling danger
That's
for purposes
correct,
of a minister determining whether this was ministerial or discretionary.
That's correct, John. Nobody could have anticipated what occurred here. It was totally unprecedented.
You had said, quote, the Court of Appeals said the possibility of the crowd surge onto the field, that you concede that was a known and compelling danger. That's the quote I had. Now, maybe you're changing your mind from that.
No,
that's what you... Are you staying with that?
If that is the danger, there was an expectation that the fans would attempt to take the field.
Okay, so that was the known and compelling danger, that they would be coming down... the fans would be coming down to the field.
If
known
Wisconsin,
and compelling.
If Wisconsin won.
What was the score?
Well, it was one in the last couple of minutes, as I recall. I don't recall the score.
You concede that this was a known and compelling danger, right? I mean, that's what I hear you say. The possibility the crowd surges onto the field. Am I wrong? Are you changing?
Well, no, it's known, but it's contingent upon Wisconsin winning. And they have to anticipate. You can't wait until the end of the game, and then if Wisconsin wins, develop a plan to deal with what you expect might happen. So it's known, but of course it's contingent on something else happening. But if that contingency occurs,
there wouldn't be a plan if it wasn't a known and compelling danger. It wouldn't have spent the time of putting together
exactly
a plan. That's the reality. That's pretty,
right.
Pretty
right.
Common sense.
Was part of the plan, things got out of hand, to open the gate for the tunnel?
No, the way the plan was supposed to work is, since in the past the only place students had been injured was on the field by the goalposts, the focus was on minimizing that danger. So the plan that was developed was to provide passive resistance to the fans, attempt to discourage them from coming over the fence. Since the fence was only about 3.5 feet high, not much of a barrier to college students, the likelihood was that a number of them would come over. If they started to come over, they were not to, defendants and the Permar personnel were not to attempt to stop them. But by letting them come over, and yet discourage them from doing so, the plan was designed to attempt to minimize the number that would come onto the field and go to the goalpost, and yet relieve congestion to some extent on the other side of the fence by permitting some to come over. Unfortunately, the number that attempted to come onto the field was so large, and they came so quickly, that plan didn't work.
There was no plan to open the gate at any point?
No, because congestion was to be relieved not in that fashion, but by allowing the students to come over the fence. You have to remember, Your Honor, that the gate was designed to protect the fans from the 250-pound football players that were attempting to exit the field, as well as the equipment personnel. So if you're going to open the gates and let the fans out that way, you've got two problems. One, in all likelihood, you would have ended up with hundreds more students on the field, which is exactly the type of danger that resulted in injury in the past. So you would have exacerbated that. Plus, you would have increased the likelihood that fans would have been injured by the football players or the equipment that was they were attempting to remove from the field. So actually, what the plaintiffs are suggesting here, I think, could very well, had it been implemented, would have made the matter, the situation worse and actually resulted in more people being injured.
That fence that somebody described as closing off the track, that they can do that. As I recall, that's the one that holds people back so that athletes can get off the field.
That's correct.
Through that entrance. That was the reason it was put where it was, I assume.
That's correct, John. It was to serve the same purpose that the ropes had served. In fact, using the ropes in this situation would probably have made matters worse because, again, it would have allowed hundreds more students to go onto the field because they probably could have broken through the ropes. So you might have prevented injuries where they occurred here by the gate, but you would probably have greatly increased the number of injuries that occurred on the field.
It seems to me one of the problems the plaintiffs have is if they dealt with the pinning effect, they could have created a hazard on the field. But your problem is that you know of a known and compelling danger about the pinning effect. What is it that was done to deal with that problem?
Oh, Your Honor, we don't concede that that was a known and compelling danger. There had never been anyone injured by that gate being closed across that track. There had been people injured in the past by fans coming onto the field and attempting to climb the goalposts. So the known danger, again, we've got to be clear on this, was the expectation...
But I thought someone from the private security service, as early as the preseason Packer game, talked about that phenomenon, and it was reinforced in the Northwestern game, and it was discussed in the meeting just before the game.
Well, yes, Your Honor, the congestion occurred there, but the injuries had never occurred. Injuries had occurred at the goalpost. And the plan was designed to relieve that congestion by permitting students to come over the fence, only to try to discourage them, but not to physically resist that.
What if they had all followed the discouragement? I mean, the problems would have been worse then, wouldn't they?
Well, arguably, except that the plan here was anticipated that, given what had occurred in the past, any number of students would not be discouraged, and they would come onto the field, which is what happened. And that, in turn, would then decrease the number of students getting to the field, as well as relieving congestion on the other side of the fence and in the tracker. Unfortunately, it didn't work, because the students came down in such numbers and so quickly that a lot of them were actually pinned against the red railing at the bottom of the bleachers and actually collapsed that metal railing, causing students to fall on the track and then students piling up on top of them about five or six deep, as well as putting so much pressure against the fence that the fence collapsed. People didn't have time to climb over the fence because there was so much pressure against them, they couldn't get up over the fence. But that was totally unexpected, unanticipated. It had never occurred before. No one thought that that would happen. And so the plan was actually a good one. Unfortunately, because of the unusual situation that developed, it didn't work. It may have worked to some extent in the sense that if the plaintiffs had actually done, or the defendants had done what the plaintiffs are suggesting, I think it's a reasonable inference that even more students would have been injured because you would have had hundreds more on the field, probably injured by the goalposts, as well as perhaps injuring field personnel as well as band members.
But could I ask you, just hypothetically, if something at Camp Randall had been unsafe, who should be sued because of that?
Structurally, you mean, Your Honor?
Yeah. Who is the appropriate defendant here?
Well, the owner of Camp Randall is the state.
And?
I suppose you could argue the Board of Regents as an agent of state, but the Board of Regents is not sui juris. It's just simply an agency of the state. It's not an independent going concern, so you would have to sue the state. The state would be protected by sovereign immunity, so I suppose you would end up in front of the claims board, which is the...
You're saying that there's no one to sue?
Under the safe play statute?
Yeah.
If you're talking about structural defect, you'd have to sue the employer or the owner. This is a government institution, so it wouldn't be an employer. It's a public building, and the owner of that building is the state. So that would be the person you would have to go after legally.
Are you essentially saying that the state isn't covered by the safe play statute, or the statute is inapplicable to the state?
Well, the state is covered in the sense that it's the owner of a public building, but the state is protected by sovereign immunity, which is what this court said in Holdsworth. I don't know what else to say about it. I mean, under the safe play statute, that is designed to place liability on the part of the owner or the employer. When you're talking about a state public building, it's the state that's the owner, so it's the state that would have to be sued. But you do run into sovereign immunity.
Let me give you a Quartz case, but just turn the fact a little bit. In Quartz, let's say in Quartz, assume that there was a sign placed out there, but it was placed in such a way that it couldn't be read. In other words, it was placed in a negligent manner. What would you be arguing today if that was the case, if Quartz was before us again with that fact?
I think this court would have to determine as a matter of law whether the state employee, in that case the park manager, Anderson, responded to the known and compelling danger. I don't think placing a sign where nobody can see it is responsive to the danger. What was done in this case was responsive to the danger. Unfortunately, it didn't work, but it was responsive. And it certainly is a question of law when you have undisputed facts, not because it's official immunity, but simply under the summary judgment rules. If the facts are undisputed, it becomes a question of law.
But so, responsive to the danger, it sounds like from Justice Babbage, the reason the sign was put up was to respond to the danger. Now, they may have done it incorrectly or negligently or stupidly, but it was responding to the danger, otherwise I wouldn't have put it up.
Well, it doesn't make any sense to me, Your Honor, though, to say that you can do anything and then claim that that's responsive to the danger. Carried to an extreme, there could be an accord situation again, or even dominoes better, where you've got a tree falling across the highway at night, and the dispatcher is aware of it. You'd have the dispatcher write a note to herself to take care of it next week. Well, I certainly wouldn't want to argue that that's responsive to the danger. It's got to be something that, as a matter of law, is responsive. Not that it'll cure the problem, because it may not. But it has to be responsive and involve the exercise of judgment or discretion. I think that's a question of law.
As long as it exercises judgment or discretion, so no matter what. So the judgment here is that the trial judge said that I'm going to grant summary judgment, but what the plaintiffs are asking for is, why shouldn't this go to a jury? Why shouldn't, isn't that the way to handle it? So they can look and see whether or not that act or judgment of the public official was exercised.
Right, that's the argument, Your Honor.
Yes.
But my response to it is that it's a question of law under the in the context of official immunity. And it's particularly a question of law in this case because it's undisputed factually that the plan was developed to respond to an anticipated attempt by the fans to take the field.
Mr. Glinsky, though, as I listen to the arguments here, you want us to define the danger your way. The plaintiffs want us to define the danger yet another way. Is there not a genuine issue of material fact given that? As to whether or not there was a known and compelling danger, especially where both sides here don't even agree as to what the danger was. And isn't that what happened when this case got from the trial court to the Court of Appeals? The judges on the two different levels couldn't agree either.
Well, of course, our position, Your Honor, is even if there was a known danger, we responded to it, so entitled to immunity. But I think what you're suggesting would really overrule Kimps, because in Kimps you had Professor Hill supervising students who were learning to teach phys ed classes in three adjacent areas of the gym, trampoline being in one, volleyball in another, and gymnastics in another. Professor Hill gave some general safety guidelines to these students, but then focused his attention on the trampoline because he thought that's where there was the greatest danger. This court didn't say that that was a jury question. In fact, this court specifically said Professor Hill is entitled to immunity for that discretionary decision to decide where to focus his time and energy where he thought there was the greatest danger.
But you've already said that if it's some outrageous act or it's very negligent or something, that then that would not be covered. In other words, that possibly could become a jury question. But you gave the tree falling over the road, and it's all a question of degree, correct?
No, Your Honor, I think it's a question of law as to whether...
Tell me the difference, then.
I think this court has to determine as a matter of law whether the discretionary activity of the defendant is responsible to the danger. You can't just have discretionary activity or decision-making that's totally unrelated to the danger and then afford immunity. That doesn't make any sense to me. It has to be something that is responsive to the danger. But I think that is a question of law.
Well, if we go that way, the way you are arguing now, aren't we, in effect, sub silentio, doing away with ministerial duty, doing away with the whole doctrine? Because at that point, then, anybody confronted with a ministerial duty, if they act, and could have acted in more than one way, they bounce right back into an immunity box.
Well, except that when you've got a known and compelling danger, such as in courts, this is what happened, the court determined as a matter of law that Anderson didn't do anything. He didn't respond to the danger. Therefore, he was stripped of the cloak of immunity, and it became a jury question. So if as a matter of
right,
law...
Well, that's why I'm saying to you, Mr. Blinsky, don't you have to prevail on the known and compelling danger thing? Because if you don't, you are asking us to essentially overrule all kinds of case law with respect to ministerial duty.
Well, that's... Yeah, right, because then it would have to be a jury question. That's what the plaintiffs are arguing. But that goes contrary to this court's previous decisions, and the clearest one, it seems to me, is Cords. Because there, if this court had applied what the plaintiffs are suggesting, you would have had a jury question as soon as the court had determined that the 90-foot drop-off next to a path that was a foot and a half wide was a known and compelling danger. Once the court determined that, it would then have to go to a jury. That's not the way the court decided, of course. It said that once there was that known and compelling danger, then Anderson had an obligation to act in response to it. The court determined as a matter of law that he had done nothing. Therefore, he was stripped of his immunity, and it went to a jury, and negligence was assessed.
The plaintiff's argument would turn every ministerial duty decision into a negligence case.
That's the way I see it, Your Honor. I don't know how you could avoid that. It just seems to me that would be the end result. As soon as a clear and compelling danger is identified, then you go to a jury. You've got a jury question. Then you just determine the amount of negligence, which essentially would strip defendants of the cloak of immunity anytime there's a known compelling danger. It wouldn't matter what they did.
But they say, of course, that you would do away with discretion. I get so confused with these terms.
Qualified immunity.
With qualified immunity. Yeah, thank you. That's it. Because the way you have it set up, it seems to me, is if there's a ministerial act, and the present law is if there's a ministerial act, and then the person performs that ministerial act and does so in a negligent manner, they are not immune. Isn't that present?
That's right, I would agree with that.
What you are saying is if there's a ministerial act and the person performs that way and has 10 different ways to perform that ministerial act, they cannot be sued for having chosen one of them.
Maybe I can clarify this. I think we have to differentiate between the two types of ministerial acts. You've got what I call the specific task type of ministerial duty, where the law clearly defines what you have to do, when you have to do it, how you have to do it, and so forth. You've also got a type of ministerial duty that was established in courts of a known and compelling danger, which creates a ministerial duty to act in some fashion in response to the danger. I'm talking only about the known and compelling danger type of ministerial duty. As far as the specific task type of ministerial duty is concerned, if that isn't performed as the law requires the defendant to perform it, immunity is gone. And there's probably...
Like putting up a highway sign or something.
Right. Of course, in the highway sign, you get a little more complicated because this court has determined that there's an obligation to put it, you know. You don't have to put it up, but once you put it up, you got to maintain it.
Once there is a known and compelling danger, there is a ministerial duty to act. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
That's what you just said. Isn't it then a jury question of whether or not the actions of the actors were negligent or not negligent?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think not. I think this court has to determine as a matter of law whether that, if there was action, whether it was responsible for the danger.
Are you really saying that, are you fighting this case on causation? Is that what I hear
no,
you saying?
No, Your Honor.
Whether or not the, it sounds to me like you are. You've got a you've conceded there's a ministerial duty to act when there's a known and compelling danger. You've conceded there's a knowing and compelling danger. So it seems to me it's a jury question, unless a matter of law there's no causation, that the failure to act had nothing to do with the known compelling danger. It seems to me that's what
you're saying. I'm saying that's a question of law to be decided by the court, but even if it wasn't in this particular case, you've got an undisputed, as an undisputed fact, the defendants responded to the danger. Nobody disputes that the plan was designed to respond to the attempt by the fans to take the field.
Did they respond in a negligent fashion is the question.
Well, you don't get to that, though, because if they've responded, they're entitled to immunity. You're eliminating immunity if you go to a jury and assess negligence. At what point would they have immunity then? It seems to me only if there was no known and compelling danger. So you're back to what Justice Babbage was suggesting, that you're simply doing away with immunity then.
Otherwise, you, as an employee, you better decide right in your discretion, or you can be sued for negligence.
I think that's what it would amount to. I think it would amount to the abolition of discretionary immunity, as we've known it in this state for many years.
Is this just simply a Kemp's case?
I think it is, Your Honor. I think it's very much unlike Koritz and Domino, where you had a clearly defined pre-existing danger. You've got a situation where you have any number of dangers, and you attempt to deal with the one on which you think creates the greatest danger.
I have a hard time, because I keep on asking you and trying to give you room to say there's no known and compelling danger, but you're coming back to me every time and saying, no, I'm conceding there's a known and compelling danger. I'm conceding there's a known and compelling danger. Kemp's, there was no known and compelling danger.
But, Your Honor, it is clear from Kemp's that even if there had been, Professor Hill would still have been entitled to discretionary immunity, and with respect to Krzyzewski, the court specifically indicated that he was entitled to discretionary immunity for the way he handled the previous problems they had with the volleyball standard, namely by sending a memo to the maintenance people that they ought to correct it, not informing the professors. The court went on to say that we don't consider that a courts-type danger, but they did say that even if it had been, Krzyzewski would have been entitled to immunity. So, but just to try to clarify your point again, I know I'm going over the same ground here, but we're conceding only that there was a known and compelling danger that the students, at least some students, would attempt to take the field if Wisconsin won the game. That was the expectation. That's why the plan was developed. If we're going to take the position that there was no known and compelling danger, why was the plan created? Okay. I mean, I think that would be inconsistent for us. I would not argue that, honestly.
But is it your position there was no known and compelling danger that people could be penned up and potentially crushed?
No, Your Honor. I'm arguing that within the context of the fans attempting to take the field, there were any number of dangers that could have occurred, and I enumerated them in the beginning. any number of things could have happened. The question is, how do you address all of those? Some simply couldn't be addressed as a practical matter. The plan that was developed was an attempt to address all of them, all of the dangers stemming from the fans attempting to take the field in the best way they could come up with, and that is with the idea of passive resistance and letting some fans come onto the field and relieving congestion in that manner on the track.
If you had five known and compelling dangers at the same time, and you addressed this one, that is enough?
Well, in this case, we're saying we addressed all of them. The fans coming onto the field directly and the rest of them indirectly through trying to relieve congestion by letting the fans come over the fence. But if you've got the situation you're describing, I think that's basically Kemp's. You've got three areas, three potential dangers. Professor Hill can only be in one place at a time. He decides to cover the trampoline because that's where he thinks the greatest danger is. He's entitled to discretionary immunity. So I think the answer to your question would be yes, if the resources don't exist to deal with all five known and compelling dangers.
Thank you.
Mr. Fine.
Oral argument is supposed to clarify things. And in fact, this has been an exercise in clarifying a number of things. First of all, the state now concedes that there was a known and compelling danger, even though it took 20 minutes to extract that concession. But now there isn't an issue of material fact, Judge Crooks. The state has conceded that point. How do we start from that proposition?
I don't think they conceded that there was a known and compelling, that to the extent, maybe I misheard him, but I think he was saying this is Kemp's, and that in Kemp's there certainly was a known danger, you know, that an accident had occurred 2 years past, 2 years prior. But they had
I mean, we've all read Kemp's, Justice Babbage. Kemp's specifically says that there wasn't a known and compelling danger. I mean, there's danger in the use of gymnastics equipment, but we're talking about something else here. We're talking about an exception to the presumption of immunity.